immediately come back over. To the consternation of the Germans, the Duke and Duchess sailed on the evening of August 1st on the American liner Excalibur. In a final report on the failure of his mission made in a long telegram to the foreign minister, Ribbentrop, personally, on the following day, Schellenberg declared that he had done everything possible right up to the last moment to prevent the departure. A brother of Franco, who was the Spanish ambassador in Lisbon, was prevailed upon to make a last-minute appeal to the Windsors not to go. The automobile carrying the ducal baggage was sabotaged, Schellenberg claimed, so that the luggage arrived at the ship late. The Germans spread rumors that a time bomb had been planted aboard the ship. Portuguese officials delayed the sailing time until they had searched the liner from top to bottom. Nevertheless, the Windsors departed that evening. The Nazi plot had failed. Schellenberg, in his final report to Ribbentrop, blamed it on the influence of Monckton, on the collapse of the Spanish plan, and on the Duke's mentality. There is one last paper on the plot in the captured files of the German foreign minister. On August 15th, the German minister in Lisbon wired Berlin, "The confidant has just received a telegram from the Duke from Bermuda, asking him to send a communication as soon as action was advisable. Should any answer be made?" No answer has been found in the Wilhelmstrasse papers. By the middle of August, Hitler had decided to conquer Great Britain by armed force. There was no need to find a new king for England. The island, like all the other conquered territory, would be ruled from Berlin. Or so Hitler thought. So much for this curious tale, as told by the secret German documents and added to by Schellenberg, who was the least reliable of men, though it is difficult to believe that he invented his own role, which he admits was a ridiculous one, out of whole cloth. In a statement made through his London solicitors on August 1, 1957, after the German documents were released for publication, the Duke branded the communications between Ribbentrop and the German ambassadors in Spain and Portugal as complete fabrications and, in part, gross distortions of the truth. Windsor explained that while in Lisbon in 1940, waiting to sail for the Bahamas, certain people, whom he discovered to be pro-Nazi sympathizers, made definite efforts to persuade him to return to Spain and not assume his post as governor. "It was even suggested to me that there would be a personal risk to the Duchess and myself if we were to proceed to the Bahamas," he said. "At no time did I ever entertain any thought of complying with such a suggestion, which I treated with the contempt it deserved." The British Foreign Office issued a formal statement declaring that the Duke never wavered in his loyalty to Great Britain during the war.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Blackstone Audio presents The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, A History of Nazi Germany, by William L. Shirer. Chapter 23. Barbarossa, The Turn of Russia. While Hitler was busy that summer of 1940 directing the conquest of the West, Stalin was taking advantage of the Führer's preoccupations by moving into the Baltic states and reaching down into the Balkans. On the surface, all was friendly between the two great dictatorships. Molotov, acting for Stalin, lost no opportunity to praise and flatter the Germans on every occasion of a new act of aggression or a fresh conquest. When Germany invaded Norway and Denmark on April 9, 1940, the Soviet foreign commissar hastened to tell Ambassador von der Schulenburg in Moscow that very morning that the Soviet government understood the measures which were forced on Germany. "We wish Germany," said Molotov, "complete success in her defensive measures." A month later, when the German ambassador called on Molotov to inform him officially of the Wehrmacht's attack in the West, which Ribbentrop had instructed his envoy to explain, was forced upon Germany by the impending Anglo-French push on the Ruhr by way of Belgium and Holland, the Soviet statesman again expressed his pleasure. "Molotov received the communication in an understanding spirit," Schulenburg wired Berlin, and added that he realized that Germany must protect herself against Anglo-French attack. He had no doubt of our success. On June 17th, the day France asked for an armistice, Molotov summoned Schulenburg to his office and expressed the warmest congratulations of the Soviet government on the splendid success of the German Wehrmacht. The foreign commissar had something else to say, and this did not sound quite so pleasant in German ears. He informed the German envoy, as the latter wired Berlin most urgent, of the Soviet action against the Baltic states, adding, and one can almost see the gleam in Molotov's eyes, that it had become necessary to put an end to all the intrigues by which England and France had tried to sow discord and mistrust between Germany and the Soviet Union in the Baltic states. To put an end to such discord, the Soviet government, Molotov added, had dispatched special emissaries to the three Baltic countries. They were, in fact, three of Stalin's best hatchet men: Dekanozov, who was sent to Lithuania, Vyshinsky to Latvia, Zhdanov to Estonia. They carried out their assignments with the thoroughness which one would expect from this trio, especially the latter two individuals. Already on June 14th, the day German troops entered Paris, the Soviet government had sent a 9-hour ultimatum to Lithuania demanding the resignation of its government, the arrest of some of its key officials, and the right to send in as many Red Army troops as it pleased. Though the Lithuanian government accepted the ultimatum, Moscow deemed its acceptance unsatisfactory. And the next day, June 15th, Soviet troops occupied the country, the only one of the Baltic states to border on Germany. During the next couple of days, similar Soviet ultimatums were dispatched to Latvia and Estonia, after which they were similarly overrun by the Red Army. Stalin could be as crude and as ruthless in these matters as Hitler, and even more cynical. The press having been suppressed, the political leaders arrested, and all parties but the communists declared illegal, elections were staged by the Russians in all three countries on July 14th, and after the respective parliaments thus elected had voted for the incorporation of their lands into the Soviet Union, the Supreme Soviet Parliament of Russia admitted them into the motherland: Lithuania on August 3rd, Latvia on August 5th, Estonia on August 6th. Adolf Hitler was humiliated, but, busy as he was trying to organize the invasion of Britain, could do nothing about it. The letters from the envoys of the three Baltic states in Berlin protesting Russian aggression were returned to them by order of Ribbentrop. To further humble the Germans, Molotov brusquely told them on August 11th to liquidate their legations in Kaunas, Riga, and Tallinn within a fortnight and close down their Baltic consulates by September 1st. The seizure of the Baltic states did not satisfy Stalin's appetite. The surprisingly quick collapse of the Anglo-French armies spurred him on to get as much as he could while the getting was good. He obviously thought there was little time to lose. On June 23rd, the day after the French formally capitulated and signed the armistice at Compiègne, Molotov again called in the Nazi ambassador in Moscow and told him that the solution of the Bessarabian question brooked no further delay. The Soviet government was determined to use force should the Romanian government decline a peaceful agreement. It expected Germany, Molotov added, not to hinder but to support the Soviets in their action. Moreover, the Soviet claim likewise extended to Bukovina. Bessarabia had been taken by Romania from Russia at the end of the First World War, but Bukovina had never belonged to it, having been under Austria until Romania grabbed it in 1919. At the negotiations in Moscow for the Nazi-Soviet pact, Ribbentrop, as he now reminded Hitler, who had questioned him about it, had been forced to give Bessarabia to the Russian sphere of interest, but he had never given away Bukovina. There was some alarm in Berlin, which spread to OKW headquarters in the West. The Wehrmacht was desperately dependent on Romanian oil, and Germany needed the foodstuffs and fodder it also got from this Balkan country. These would be lost if the Red Army occupied Romania. Some time back, on May 23rd, at the height of the Battle of France, the Romanian General Staff had sent an SOS to OKW informing it that Soviet troops were concentrating on the border. Jodl summed up the reaction at Hitler's headquarters in his diary the next day: "Situation in East becomes threatening because of Russian concentration of force against Bessarabia." On the night of June 26th, Russia delivered an ultimatum to Romania demanding the ceding to it of Bessarabia and northern Bukovina, and insisting on a reply the next day. Ribbentrop, in panic, dashed off instructions from his special train to his minister in Bucharest, telling him to advise the Romanian government to yield. which it did on June 27th. Soviet troops marched into the newly acquired territories the next day, and Berlin breathed a sigh of relief that at least the rich sources of oil and food had not been cut off by Russia's grabbing the whole of Romania. It is clear from his acts and from the secret German papers that though Stalin was out to get all he could in Eastern Europe while the Germans were tied down in the West, he did not wish or contemplate a break with Hitler. Toward the end of June, Churchill had tried to warn Stalin in a personal letter of the danger of the German conquests to Russia as well as to Britain. The Soviet dictator did not bother to answer. Probably, like almost everyone else, he thought Britain was finished. So he tattled to the Germans what the British government was up to. Sir Stafford Cripps, a left-wing Labour Party leader whom the Prime Minister had rushed to Moscow as the new British ambassador in the hope of striking a more responsive chord among the Bolsheviks, a forlorn hope, as he later ruefully admitted, was received by Stalin early in July in an interview that Churchill described as formal and frigid. On July 13th, Molotov, on Stalin's instructions, handed the German ambassador a written memorandum of this confidential conversation. It is an interesting document. It reveals, as no other source does, the severe limitations of the Soviet dictator in his cold calculations of foreign affairs. Schulenburg sped it to Berlin most urgent and, of course, secret, and Ribbentrop was so grateful for its contents that he told the Soviet government he greatly appreciated this information. Cripps had pressed Stalin, the memorandum said, for his attitude on this principal question, among others. The British government was convinced that Germany was striving for hegemony in Europe. This was dangerous to the Soviet Union as well as England. Therefore, both countries ought to agree on a common policy of self-protection against Germany and on the re-establishment of the European balance of power. Stalin's answers are given as follows. He did not see any danger of the hegemony of any one country in Europe, and still less any danger that Europe might be engulfed by Germany. Stalin observed the policy of Germany and knew several leading German statesmen well. He had not discovered any desire on their part to engulf European countries. Stalin was not of the opinion that German military successes menaced the Soviet Union and her friendly relations with Germany. Such staggering smugness, such abysmal ignorance, leave one breathless. The Russian tyrant did not know, of course, the secrets of Hitler's turgid mind, but the Führer's past behavior, his known ambitions, and the unexpectedly rapid Nazi conquests ought to have been enough to warn him of the dire danger the Soviet Union was now in. But incomprehensibly, they were not enough. From the captured Nazi documents and from the testimony of many leading German figures in the great drama that was being played over the vast expanse of Western Europe that year, it is plain that at the very moment of Stalin's monumental complacency, Hitler had in fact been mulling over in his mind the idea of turning on the Soviet Union and destroying her. The basic idea went back much further, at least 15 years, to Mein Kampf. "And so we National Socialists," Hitler wrote, "take up where we broke off 600 years ago. We stop the endless German movement toward the south and west of Europe and turn our gaze toward the lands of the east. When we speak of new territory in Europe today, we must think principally of Russia and her border vassal states. Destiny itself seems to wish to point out the way to us here. This colossal empire in the east is ripe for dissolution, and the end of the Jewish domination in Russia will also be the end of Russia as a state." This idea lay like bedrock in Hitler's mind, and his pact with Stalin had not changed it at all, but merely postponed acting on it. And but briefly. In fact, less than 2 months after the deal was signed and had been utilized to destroy Poland, the Führer instructed the army that the conquered Polish territory was to be regarded as an assembly area for future German operations. The date was October 18, 1939, and Halder recorded it that day in his diary. 5 weeks later, on November 23rd, when he harangued his reluctant generals about attacking in the West, Russia was by no means out of his mind. "We can oppose Russia," he declared, "only when we are free in the West." At that time, the two-front war, the nightmare of German generals for a century, was very much on Hitler's mind, and he spoke of it at length on this occasion. He would not repeat the mistake of former German rulers. He would continue to see to it that the army had one front at a time. It was only natural, then, that with the fall of France, the chasing of the British army across the Channel, and the prospects of Britain's imminent collapse, Hitler's thoughts should turn once again to Russia. For he now supposed himself to be free in the West, and thereby to have achieved the one condition he had laid down in order to be in a position to oppose Russia. The rapidity with which Stalin seized the Baltic states and the two Romanian provinces in June spurred Hitler to a decision. The moment of its making can now be traced. Jodl says that the fundamental decision was taken as far back as during the Western campaign. Colonel Walter Varlamont, Jodl's deputy at OKW, remembers that on July 29th, Jodl announced at a meeting of operations staff officers that Hitler intended to attack the USSR in the spring of 1941. Sometime previous to this meeting, Jodl related, Hitler had told Keitel that he intended to launch the attack against the USSR during the fall of 1940. But this was too much even for Keitel, and he had argued Hitler out of it by contending that not only the bad weather in the autumn, but the difficulties of transferring the bulk of the army from the west to the east made it impossible. By the time of this conference on July 29th, Varlamont relates, the date for the intended attack against Russia had been moved back to the spring of 1941. Only a week before, we know from Halder's diary, the Führer had still held to a possible campaign in Russia for the autumn, if Britain were not invaded. At a military conference in Berlin on July 21st, he told Brauchitsch to get busy on the preparations for it. That the army commander-in-chief and his general staff already had given the problem some thought, but not enough thought, is evident from his response to Hitler. Brauchitsch told the leader that the campaign would last 4 to 6 weeks, and that the aim would be to defeat the Russian army, or at least to occupy enough Russian territory so that Soviet bombers could not reach Berlin or the Silesian industrial area, while, on the other hand, the Luftwaffe bombers could reach all important objectives in the Soviet Union. Brauchitsch thought that from 80 to 100 German divisions could do the job. He assessed Russian strength as 50 to 75 good divisions. Halder's notes on what Brauchitsch told him of the meeting show that Hitler had been stung by Stalin's grabs in the east, that he thought the Soviet dictator was coquetting with England in order to encourage her to hold out, but that he had seen no signs that Russia was preparing to enter the war against Germany. At a further conference at the Berghof on the last day of July 1940, the receding prospects of an invasion of Britain prompted Hitler to announce for the first time to his army chiefs his decision on Russia. Halder was personally present this time and jotted down his shorthand notes of exactly what the warlord said. They reveal not only that Hitler had made a definite decision to attack Russia in the following spring, but that he had already worked out in his mind the major strategic aims. Britain's hope, Hitler said, lies in Russia and America. If that hope in Russia is destroyed, then it will be destroyed for America too, because elimination of Russia will enormously increase Japan's power in the Far East. The more he thought of it, the more convinced he was, Hitler said, that Britain's stubborn determination to continue the war was due to its counting on the Soviet Union. Something strange, he explained, has happened in Britain. The British were already completely down. Halder uses the English word down here in the German text. Now they are back on their feet. Intercepted conversations. Russia unpleasantly disturbed by the swift developments in Western Europe. Russia needs only to hint to England that she does not wish to see Germany too strong, and the English, like a drowning man, will regain hope that the situation in 6 to 8 months will have completely changed. But if Russia is smashed, Britain's last hope will be shattered. Then Germany will be master of Europe and the Balkans. Decision. In view of these considerations, Russia must be liquidated. Spring 1941. The sooner Russia is smashed, the better. The Nazi warlord then elaborated on his strategic plans, which it was obvious to the generals had been ripening in his mind for some time, despite all his preoccupations with the fighting in the West. The operation, he said, would be worth carrying out only if its aim was to shatter the Soviet nation in one great blow. Conquering a lot of Russian territory would not be enough. Wiping out of the very power to exist of Russia, that is the goal, Hitler emphasized. There would be two initial drives, one in the south to Kiev and the Dnieper River, the second in the north up through the Baltic states and then toward Moscow. There the two armies would make a junction. After that, a special operation if necessary to secure the Baku oil fields. The very thought of such new conquests excited Hitler. He already had in mind what he would do with them. He would annex outright, he said, the Ukraine, White Russia, and the Baltic states, and extend Finland's territory to the White Sea. For the whole operation, he would allot 120 divisions, keeping 60 divisions for the defense of the West and Scandinavia. The attack, he laid it down, would begin in May 1941 and would take 5 months to carry through. It would be finished by winter. He would have preferred, he said, to do it this year, but this had not proved possible. The next day, August 1st, Halder went to work on the plans with his general staff. Though he would later claim to have opposed the whole idea of an attack on Russia as insane, his diary entry for this day discloses him full of enthusiasm as he applied himself to the challenging new task. Planning now went ahead with typical German thoroughness on three levels, that of the Army General Staff, of Varlamont's Operations Staff at OKW, of General Tomas's Economic and Armaments Branch of OKW. Tomas was instructed on August 14th by Goering that Hitler desired deliveries of ordered goods to the Russians only till spring of 1941. In his report on this, Tomas stresses how punctual Soviet deliveries of goods to Germany were at this time. In fact, he says, they continued to be right up to the start of the attack, and observes, not without amusement, that even during the last few days, shipments of India rubber from the Far East were completed, by the Russians, over express transit trains, presumably over the Trans-Siberian Railway. In the meantime, his office was to make a detailed survey of Soviet industry, transportation, and oil centers, both as a guide to targets and later on as an aid for administering Russia. A few days before, on August 9th, Varlamont had got out his first directive for preparing the deployment areas in the east for the jump-off against the Russians. The code name for this was Aufbau Ost, Build Up East. On August 26th, Hitler ordered 10 infantry and 2 armored divisions to be sent from the west to Poland. The panzer units, he stipulated, were to be concentrated in southeastern Poland so that they could intervene to protect the Romanian oil fields. The transfer of large bodies of troops to the east could not be done without exciting Stalin's easily aroused suspicions if he learned of it, and the Germans went to great lengths to see that he didn't. The Germans had kept only 7 divisions in Poland, 2 of which were transferred to the west during the spring campaign. The troops there, Halder cracked, were scarcely enough to maintain the customs service. If Stalin had attacked Germany in June 1940, the Red Army probably could have got to Berlin before any serious resistance was organized. Since some movements were bound to be detected, General Ernst Köstring, the German military attaché in Moscow, was instructed to inform the Soviet General Staff that it was merely a question of replacing older men, who were being released to industry, by younger men. On September 6th, Jodl got out a directive outlining in considerable detail the means of camouflage and deception. "These regroupings," he laid it down, "must not create the impression in Russia that we are preparing an offensive in the east." So that the armed services should not rest on their laurels after the great victories of the summer, Hitler issued on November 12, 1940, a comprehensive top-secret directive outlining new military tasks all over Europe and beyond. We shall come back to some of them. What concerns us here is that portion dealing with the Soviet Union. Political discussions have been initiated with the aim of clarifying Russia's attitude for the time being. Irrespective of the results of these discussions, all preparations for the East which have already been verbally ordered will be continued. Instructions on this will follow as soon as the general outline of the Army's operational plans have been submitted to and approved by me. As a matter of fact, on that very day, November 12th, Molotov arrived in Berlin to continue with Hitler himself those political discussions. Molotov in Berlin. Relations between Berlin and Moscow had for some months been souring. It was one thing for Stalin and Hitler to double-cross third parties, but quite another when they began to double-cross each other. Hitler had been helpless to prevent the Russians from grabbing the Baltic states and the 2 Romanian provinces of Bessarabia and northern Bukovina, and his frustration only added to his growing resentment. The Russian drive westward would have to be stopped, and first of all in Romania, whose oil resources were of vital importance to a Germany which, because of the British blockade, could no longer import petroleum by sea. To complicate Hitler's problem, Hungary and Bulgaria too demanded slices of Romanian territory. Hungary, in fact, as the summer of 1940 approached its end, prepared to go to war in order to win back Transylvania, which Romania had taken from her after the First World War. Such a war, Hitler realized, would cut off Germany from her main source of crude oil and probably bring the Russians in to occupy all of Romania and rob the Reich permanently of Romanian oil. By August 28th, the situation had become so threatening that Hitler ordered 5 panzer and 3 motorized divisions, plus parachute and airborne troops, to make ready to seize the Romanian oil fields on September 1st. That same day, he conferred with Ribbentrop and Chano at the Berghof and then dispatched them to Vienna, where they were to lay down the law to the foreign ministers of Hungary and Romania and make them accept Axis arbitration. This mission was accomplished without much trouble after Ribbentrop had browbeaten both sides. On August 30th, at the Belvedere Palace in Vienna, the Hungarians and Romanians accepted the Axis settlement. When Mihai Manuelescu, the Romanian foreign minister, saw the map stipulating that about one half of Transylvania should go to Hungary, he fainted, falling across the table at which the signing of the agreement was taking place, and regaining consciousness only after physicians had worked over him with camphor. It cost King Karl his throne. On September 6th, he abdicated in favor of his 18-year-old son, Mikhail, and fled with his red-haired mistress, Magda Lupescu, in a 10-car special train filled with what might be described as loot, across Yugoslavia to Switzerland. General Ion Antonescu, chief of the fascist Iron Guard and a friend of Hitler, became dictator. Ostensibly for her reasonableness, but really to give Hitler a legal excuse for his further plans, Romania received from Germany and Italy a guarantee of what was left of her territory, minus southern Dobrudja, which Romania was forced to cede to Bulgaria. Light on the Führer's further plans came to his intimates 3 weeks later. On September 20th, in a top-secret directive, Hitler ordered the sending of military missions to Romania. To the world, their tasks will be to guide friendly Romania in organizing and instructing her forces. The real tasks, which must not become apparent either to the Romanians or to our own troops, will be to protect the oil district, to prepare for deployment from Romanian bases of German and Romanian forces in case a war with Soviet Russia is forced upon us. That would take care of the southern flank of a new front he was beginning to picture in his mind. The Vienna Award, and especially the German guarantee of Romania's remaining territory, went down badly in Moscow, which had not been consulted. When Schulenburg called on Molotov on September 1st to present a windy memorandum from Ribbentrop attempting to explain and justify what had taken place in Vienna, the foreign commissar, the ambassador reported, was reserved in contrast to his usual manner. He was not too reserved, however, to lodge a strong verbal protest. He accused the German government of violating Article 3 of the Nazi-Soviet Pact, which called for consultation, and of presenting Russia with accomplished facts, which conflicted with German assurances about questions of common interests. The thieves, as is almost inevitable in such cases, had begun to quarrel over the spoils. Recriminations became more heated in the following days. On September 3rd, Ribbentrop telegraphed a long memorandum to Moscow, denying that Germany had violated the Moscow Pact, and accusing Russia of having done just that by gobbling up the Baltic states and 2 Romanian provinces without consulting Berlin. The memorandum was couched in strong language, and the Russians replied to it on September 21st with equally stern words. By this time, both sides were putting their cases in writing. The Soviet answer reiterated that Germany had broken the pact, warned that Russia still had many interests in Romania, and concluded with a sarcastic proposal that if the article calling for consultation involved certain inconveniences and restrictions for the Reich, the Soviet government was ready to amend or delete this clause of the treaty. The Kremlin's suspicions of Hitler were further aroused by 2 events in September. On the 16th, Ribbentrop wired Schulenburg to call on Molotov and casually inform him that German reinforcements for northern Norway were going to be sent by way of Finland. A few days later, on September 25th, the Nazi foreign minister got off another telegram to the embassy in Moscow, this time addressed to the chargé, Schulenburg having returned to Germany on leave. It was a most confidential message, being marked strictly secret, state secret, and directing that its instructions were to be carried out only if on the next day the chargé received from Berlin by wire or telephone a special code word. He was to inform Molotov that in the next few days, Japan, Italy, and Germany were going to sign in Berlin a military alliance. It was not to be directed against Russia. A specific article would say that. This alliance, Ribbentrop stated, is directed exclusively against American warmongers. To be sure, this is, as usual, not expressly stated in the treaty, but can be unmistakably inferred from its terms. Its exclusive purpose is to bring the elements pressing for America's entry into the war to their senses by conclusively demonstrating to them that if they enter the present struggle, they will automatically have to deal with the three great powers as adversaries. The chilly Soviet foreign commissar, whose suspicions of the Germans were now growing like flowers in June, was highly skeptical when Werner von Tippelskirch, the chargé, brought him this news on the evening of September 26th. He said immediately, with that pedantic attention to detail which so annoyed all with whom he negotiated, friend or foe, that according to Article 4 of the Moscow Pact, the Soviet government was entitled to see the text of this tripartite military alliance before it was signed, including, he added, the text of any secret protocols. Molotov also wanted to know more about the German agreement with Finland for the transport of troops through that country, which he had heard of mostly through the press, he said, including a United Press dispatch from Berlin. During the last 3 days, Molotov added, Moscow had received reports of the landing of German forces in at least three Finnish ports, without having been informed thereof by Germany. The Soviet government, Molotov continued, wished to receive the text of the agreement on the passage of troops through Finland, including its secret portions, and to be informed as to the object of the agreement, against whom it was directed, and the purposes that were being served thereby. The Russians had to be mollified, even the obtuse Ribbentrop could see that, and on October 2nd he telegraphed to Moscow what he said was the text of the agreement with Finland. He also reiterated that the Tripartite Pact, which in the meantime had been signed, was not directed against the Soviet Union, and solemnly declared that there were no secret protocols nor any other secret agreements. It was signed in Berlin on September 27, 1940, in a comic opera setting and ceremony which I have described elsewhere, Berlin Diary, pages 532-537. In Articles 1 and 2, respectively, Japan recognized the leadership of Germany and Italy in the establishment of a new order in Europe, and the two countries recognized Japan's leadership for the same in Greater East Asia. Article 3 provided for mutual assistance should any one of the powers be attacked by the United States, though America was not specifically mentioned, only defined. To me, as I wrote in my diary that day in Berlin, the most significant thing about the pact was that it meant that Hitler was now reconciled to a long war. Ciano, who signed the pact for Italy, came to the same conclusion. Ciano Diaries, page 296. Also, despite the disclaimer, the pact was, and was meant to be, a warning to the Soviet Union. After instructing Tippelskirch on October 7th to inform Molotov, incidentally, that a German military mission was being sent to Romania, and after receiving Molotov's skeptical reaction to this further news, "How many troops are you sending to Romania?" the foreign commissar had demanded to know. Ribbentrop, on October 13th, got off a long letter to Stalin in an attempt to quiet Soviet uneasiness about Germany. It is, as might be expected, a fatuous and at the same time arrogant epistle, abounding in nonsense and lies and subterfuge. England is blamed for the war and all its aftermaths thus far, but one thing is sure. The war as such has been won by us. It is only a question of how long it will be before England admits to collapse. The German moves against Russia in Finland and Romania, as well as the Tripartite Pact, are explained as really a boon to Russia. In the meantime, British diplomacy and British secret agents are trying to stir up trouble between Russia and Germany. To frustrate them, why not send Molotov to Berlin, Ribbentrop asked Stalin, so that the Führer could explain personally his views regarding the future molding of relations between our two countries. Ribbentrop gave a sly hint what those views were. Nothing less than dividing up the world among the four totalitarian powers. "It appears to be the mission of the four powers," he said, "the Soviet Union, Italy, Japan, and Germany, to adopt a long-range policy by delimitation of their interests on a worldwide scale." There was some delay in the German embassy in Moscow in getting this letter to its destination, which made Ribbentrop livid with rage and inspired an angry telegram from him to Schulenburg demanding to know why his letter had not been delivered until the 17th, and why, in keeping with the importance of its contents, it was not delivered to Stalin personally. Schulenburg had handed it to Molotov. Stalin replied on October 22nd in a remarkably cordial tone. "Molotov admits," he wrote, "that he is under obligation to pay you a visit in Berlin. He hereby accepts your invitation." Stalin's geniality must have been only a mask. Schulenburg wired Berlin a few days later that the Russians were protesting the refusal of Germany to deliver war material while at the same time shipping arms to Finland. "This is the first time," Schulenburg advised Berlin, "that our deliveries of arms to Finland have been mentioned by the Soviets." A dark, drizzling day, and Molotov arrived, his reception being extremely stiff and formal. Driving up the Linden to the Soviet embassy, he looked to me like a plugging provincial schoolmaster. But to have survived in the cutthroat competition of the Kremlin, he must have something. The Germans talked glibly of letting Moscow have that old Russian dream, the Bosporus and the Dardanelles, while they will take the rest of the Balkans, Romania, Yugoslavia, and Bulgaria. Thus began my diary entry in Berlin on November 12, 1940. The glib talk of the Germans was accurate enough as far as it went. Today we know much more about this strange and, as it turned out, fateful meeting, thanks to the capture of the Foreign Office documents, in which one finds the confidential German minutes of the two-day sessions, all but one of them kept by the ubiquitous Dr. Schmidt. Their accuracy on this occasion was later confirmed by Stalin, though not intentionally. Churchill says he received an account of Molotov's talks in Berlin from Stalin in August 1942, which in no essential differs from the German record, though it was more pithy. Churchill, Their Finest Hour, pages 585 to 586. At the first meeting between the two foreign ministers, during the forenoon of November 12th, Ribbentrop was in one of his most vapid and arrogant moods, but Molotov quickly saw through him and sized up what the German game was. "England," Ribbentrop began, "is beaten, and it is only a question of time when she will finally admit her defeat. The beginning of the end has now arrived for the British Empire." The British, it was true, were hoping for aid from America, but the entry of the United States into the war is of no consequence at all for Germany. Germany and Italy will never again allow an Anglo-Saxon to land on the European continent. This is no military problem at all. The Axis powers are therefore not considering how they can win the war, but rather how rapidly they can end the war which is already won. This being so, Ribbentrop explained, the time had come for the four powers, Russia, Germany, Italy, and Japan, to define their spheres of interest. The Führer, he said, had concluded that all four countries would naturally expand in a southerly direction. Japan had already turned south, as had Italy, while Germany, after the establishment of the New Order in Western Europe, would find her additional Lebensraum in, of all places, Central Africa. Ribbentrop said he wondered if Russia would also not turn to the south for the natural outlet to the open sea which was so important for her. "Which sea?" Molotov interjected icily. This was an awkward but crucial question, as the Germans would learn during the next 36 hours of ceaseless conversations with this stubborn, prosaic, precise Bolshevik. The interruption floored Ribbentrop for a moment, and he could not think of an answer. Instead, he rambled on about the great changes that would take place all over the world after the war, and gabbled that the important thing was that both partners to the German-Russian pact had together done some good business, and would continue to do some business. But when Molotov insisted on an answer to his simple question, Ribbentrop finally replied by suggesting that, in the long run, the most advantageous access to the sea for Russia could be found in the direction of the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea. Molotov sat there, says Dr. Schmidt, who was present taking notes, with an impenetrable expression. He said very little, except to comment at the end that precision and vigilance were necessary in delimiting spheres of interest, particularly between Germany and Russia. The wily Soviet negotiator was saving his ammunition for Hitler, whom he saw in the afternoon. For the all-powerful Nazi warlord, it turned out to be quite a surprising, nerve-wracking, frustrating, and even unique experience. Hitler was just as vague as his foreign minister, and even more grandiose. As soon as the weather improved, he began by saying, Germany would strike the final blow against England. There was, to be sure, the problem of America. But the United States could not endanger the freedom of other nations before 1970 or 1980. It had no business either in Europe, in Africa, or in Asia, an assertion which Molotov broke in to say he was in agreement with. But he was not in agreement with much else that Hitler said. After the Nazi leader had finished a lengthy exposition of pleasant generalities, stressing that there were no fundamental differences between the two countries in the pursuit of their respective aspirations and in their common drive toward access to the ocean, Molotov replied that the statements of the Führer had been of a general nature. He would now, he said, set forth the ideas of Stalin, who on his departure from Moscow had given him exact instructions. Whereupon he hurled the book at the German dictator, who, as the minutes make clear, was scarcely prepared for it. The questions hailed down upon Hitler, Schmidt afterward recalled. No foreign visitor had ever spoken to him in this way in my presence. What was Germany up to in Finland? Molotov wanted to know. What was the meaning of the new order in Europe and in Asia? And what role would the USSR be given in it? What was the significance of the Tripartite Pact? Moreover, he continued, there are issues to be clarified regarding Russia's Balkan and Black Sea interests with respect to Bulgaria, Romania, and Turkey. He would like, he said, to hear some answers and explanations. Hitler, perhaps for the first time in his life, was too taken aback to answer. He proposed that they adjourn in view of a possible air raid alarm, promising to go into a detailed discussion the next day. A showdown had been postponed but not prevented, and the next morning when Hitler and Molotov resumed their talks, the Russian commissar was relentless. To begin with, about Finland, over which the two men soon became embroiled in a bitter and caustic dispute. Molotov demanded that Germany get its troops out of Finland. Hitler denied that Finland was occupied by German troops. They were merely being sent through Finland to Norway. But he wanted to know whether Russia intended to go to war against Finland. According to the German minutes, Molotov answered this question somewhat evasively, and Hitler was not satisfied. There must be no war in the Baltic, Hitler insisted. It would put a heavy strain on German-Russian relations, a threat which he added to a moment later by saying that such a strain might bring unforeseeable consequences. What more did the Soviet Union want in Finland anyway? Hitler wanted to know, and his visitor answered that it wanted a settlement on the same scale as in Bessarabia, which meant outright annexation. Hitler's reaction to this must have perturbed even the imperturbable Russian, who hastened to ask the Führer's opinion on that. The dictator in turn was somewhat evasive, replying that he could only repeat that there must be no war with Finland because such a conflict might have far-reaching repercussions. A new factor has been introduced into the discussion by this position, Molotov retorted. So heated had the dispute become that Ribbentrop, who must have become thoroughly frightened by this time, broke in to say, according to the German minutes, that there was actually no reason at all for making an issue of the Finnish question. Perhaps it was merely a misunderstanding. Hitler took advantage of this timely intervention to quickly change the subject. Could not the Russians be tempted by the unlimited plunder soon to be available with the collapse of the British Empire? Let us turn to more important problems, he said. After the conquest of England, he declared, the British Empire would be apportioned as a gigantic worldwide estate in bankruptcy of 40 million square kilometers. In this bankrupt estate, there would be for Russia access to the ice-free and really open ocean. Thus far, a minority of 45 million Englishmen had ruled 600 million inhabitants of the British Empire. He was about to crush this minority. Under these circumstances, there arose worldwide perspectives. All the countries which could possibly be interested in the bankrupt estate would have to stop all controversies among themselves and concern themselves exclusively with the partition of the British Empire. This applied to Germany, France, Italy, Russia, and Japan. The chilly, impassive Russian guest did not appear to be moved by such glittering worldwide perspectives, nor was he as convinced as the Germans, a point he later rubbed in, that the British Empire would soon be there for the taking. He wanted, he said, to discuss problems closer to Europe, Turkey, for instance, and Bulgaria and Romania. The Soviet government, he said, is of the opinion that the German guarantee of Romania is aimed against the interests of Soviet Russia, if one may express oneself so bluntly. He had been expressing himself bluntly all day to the growing annoyance of his hosts, and now he pressed on. He demanded that Germany revoke this guarantee. Hitler declined. "All right," Molotov persisted. "In view of Moscow's interest in the Straits, what would Germany say if Russia gave Bulgaria a guarantee under exactly the same conditions as Germany and Italy had given one to Romania?" One can almost see Hitler's dark frown. He inquired whether Bulgaria had asked for such a guarantee, as had Romania. He, the Führer, the German memorandum quotes him as adding, did not know of any request by Bulgaria. At any rate, he would first have to consult Mussolini before giving the Russians a more definite answer to their question. And he added ominously that if Germany were perchance looking for sources of friction with Russia, she would not need the Straits for that. But the Führer, usually so talkative, had no more stomach for talk with this impossible Russian. At this point in the conversation, say the German minutes, the Führer called attention to the late hour and stated that in view of the possibility of English air attacks, it would be better to break off the talk now, since the main issues had probably been sufficiently discussed. That night, Molotov gave a gala banquet to his hosts at the Russian embassy on Unter den Linden. Hitler, apparently exhausted and still irritated by the afternoon's ordeal, did not put in an appearance. The British did. I had wondered why their bombers had not appeared over Berlin, as they had almost every recent night, to remind the Soviet commissar on his first evening in the capital that, whatever the Germans told him, Britain was still in the war and kicking. Some of us, I confess, had waited hopefully for the planes, but they had not come. Officials in the Wilhelmstrasse, who had feared the worst, were visibly relieved, but not for long. On the evening of November 13th, the British came over early. Churchill says the air raid was timed for this occasion. "We had heard of the conference beforehand," he later wrote, "and though not invited to join in the discussion, did not wish to be entirely left out of the proceedings." Churchill, Their Finest Hour, page 584. It gets dark in Berlin about 4 p.m. at this time of year, and shortly after 9 o'clock the air raid sirens began to whine, and then you could hear the thunder of the flak guns, and in between the hum of the bombers overhead. According to Dr. Schmidt, who was at the banquet in the Soviet embassy, Molotov had just proposed a friendly toast, and Ribbentrop had risen to his feet to reply when the air raid warning was sounded and the guests scattered to shelter. I remember the hurrying and scurrying down the Linden and around the corner at the Wilhelmstrasse as Germans and Russians made for the underground shelter of the Foreign Ministry. Some of the officials, Dr. Schmidt among them, ducked into the Adlon Hotel, from in front of which some of us were watching, and were unable to get to the impromptu meeting which the two foreign ministers now held in the underground depths of the Foreign Office. The minutes of this meeting were therefore taken, in the enforced absence of Dr. Schmidt, by Gustav Hilger, counselor of the German embassy in Moscow, who had acted as one of the interpreters during the conference. While the British bombers cruised overhead in the night and the anti-aircraft guns fired away ineffectively at them, the slippery Nazi foreign minister tried one last time to take the Russians in. Out of his pocket he pulled a draft of an agreement which, in substance, transformed the tripartite pact into a four-power pact, with Russia as the fourth member. Molotov listened patiently while Ribbentrop read it through. Article 2 was the core. In it, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the Soviet Union undertook to respect each other's natural spheres of influence. Any disputes concerning them would be settled in an amicable way. The two fascist countries and Japan agreed to recognize the present extent of the possessions of the Soviet Union and will respect it. All four countries in Article 3 agreed not to join or support any combination directed against one of the four powers. The agreement itself, Ribbentrop proposed, would be made public, but not, of course, its secret protocols, which he next proceeded to read. The most important one defined each country's territorial aspirations. Russia's was to center south of the national territory of the Soviet Union in the direction of the Indian Ocean. Molotov did not rise to the bait. The proposed treaty was obviously an attempt to divert Russia from its historic pressure westward, down the Baltic, into the Balkans, and through the Straits to the Mediterranean, where inevitably it would clash with the greedy designs of Germany and Italy. The USSR was not, at least at the moment, interested in the Indian Ocean, which lay far away. What it was interested in at the moment, Molotov replied, was Europe and the Turkish Straits. Consequently, he added, paper agreements will not suffice for the Soviet Union. She would have to insist on effective guarantees of her security. The questions which interested the Soviet Union, he elaborated, concerned not only Turkey but Bulgaria, but the fate of Romania and Hungary was also of interest to the USSR and could not be immaterial to her under any circumstances. It would further interest the Soviet government to learn what the Axis contemplated with regard to Yugoslavia and Greece, and likewise what Germany intended with regard to Poland. The Soviet government was also interested in the question of Swedish neutrality. Besides, there existed the question of the passages out of the Baltic Sea. The untiring, poker-faced Soviet foreign commissar left nothing out, and Ribbentrop, who felt himself being buried under the avalanche of questions, for at this point Molotov said he would appreciate it if his guest made answer to them, protested that he was being interrogated too closely. He could only repeat again and again, he replied weakly, that the decisive question was whether the Soviet Union was prepared and in a position to cooperate with us in the great liquidation of the British Empire. Molotov was ready with a cutting retort. Hilger duly noted it in the minutes. In his reply, Molotov stated that the Germans were assuming that the war against England had already actually been won. If, therefore, as Hitler had maintained, Germany was waging a life-and-death struggle against England, he could only construe this as meaning that Germany was fighting for life, and England for death. This sarcasm may have gone over the head of Ribbentrop, a man of monumental denseness, but Molotov took no chances. To the Germans' constant reiteration that Britain was finished, the commissar finally replied, "If that is so, why are we in this shelter, and whose are these bombs which fall?" Molotov's parting shot is given by Churchill, to whom it was related by Stalin later in the war. Churchill, Their Finest Hour, page 586. From this wearing experience with Moscow's tough bargainer, and from further evidence that came a fortnight later of Stalin's increasingly rapacious appetite, Hitler drew his final conclusions. It must be set down here that the Soviet dictator, his subsequent claims to the contrary notwithstanding, now accepted Hitler's offer to join the fascist camp, though at a stiffer price than had been offered in Berlin. On November 26th, scarcely 2 weeks after Molotov had returned from Germany, he informed the German ambassador in Moscow that Russia was prepared to join the four-power pact, subject to the following conditions. 1. The German troops are immediately withdrawn from Finland, which belongs to the Soviet Union's sphere of influence. 2. That within the next few months, the security of the Soviet Union in the Straits is assured by the conclusion of a mutual assistance pact between the USSR and Bulgaria, and by the establishment of a base for land and naval forces by the Soviet Union within range of the Bosporus and the Dardanelles by means of a long-term lease. 3. That the area south of Batum and Baku in the general direction of the Persian Gulf is recognized as the center of the aspirations of the Soviet Union. 4. That Japan renounce her rights to concessions for coal and oil in northern Sakhalin. In all, Stalin asked for 5 instead of 2 secret protocols embodying his new proposals, and for good measure asked that, should Turkey prove difficult about Russian bases controlling the straits, the four powers take military measures against her. The proposals constituted a price higher than Hitler was willing even to consider. He had tried to keep Russia out of Europe, but now Stalin was demanding Finland, Bulgaria, control of the Straits, and, in effect, the Arabian and Persian oil fields, which normally supplied Europe with most of its oil. The Russians did not even mention the Indian Ocean, which the Führer had tried to fob off as the center of aspirations for the USSR. "Stalin is clever and cunning," Hitler told his top military chiefs. "He demands more and more. He's a cold-blooded blackmailer. A German victory has become unbearable for Russia. Therefore, she must be brought to her knees as soon as possible." The great cold-blooded Nazi blackmailer had met his match, and the realization infuriated him. At the beginning of December, he told Halder to bring him the Army General Staff's plan for the onslaught on the Soviet Union. On December 5th, Halder and Brauchitsch dutifully brought it to him, and at the end of a 4-hour conference, he approved it. Both the captured OKW war diary and Halder's own confidential journal contain a report on this crucial meeting. The Nazi warlord stressed that the Red Army must be broken through, both north and south of the Pripet Marshes, surrounded and annihilated, as in Poland. Moscow, he told Halder, was not important. The important thing was to destroy the life force of Russia. Romania and Finland were to join in the attack, but not Hungary. General Dietl's mountain division at Narvik was to be transported across northern Sweden to Finland for an attack on the Soviet Arctic region. Sweden, which had refused transit to the Allies during the Russo-Finnish War, permitted this fully armed division to pass through. Hungary, of course, later joined in the war against Russia. Altogether, some 120 to 130 divisions were allotted for the big campaign. In its report on this conference, as in previous references to the plan to attack Russia, General Halder's diary employs the codename Otto. Less than a fortnight later, on December 18, 1940, the codename by which it will go down in history was substituted. On this day, Hitler crossed the Rubicon. He issued Directive No. 21. It was headed Operation Barbarossa. It began, "Top Secret. The Führer's Headquarters, December 18, 1940. The German armed forces must be prepared to crush Soviet Russia in a quick campaign before the end of the war against England. For this purpose, the army will have to employ all available units with the reservation that the occupied territories will have to be safeguarded against surprise attacks. Preparations are to be completed by May 15, 1941. Great caution has to be exercised that the intention of an attack will not be recognized." So, the target date was mid-May of the following spring. The general purpose of Operation Barbarossa Hitler laid down as follows. "The mass of the Russian army in Western Russia is to be destroyed in daring operations by driving forward deep armored wedges, and the retreat of intact battle-ready troops into the wide spaces of Russia is to be prevented. The ultimate objective of the operation is to establish a defense line against Asiatic Russia from a line running from the Volga River to Archangel." Hitler's directive then went into considerable detail about the main lines of attack. A good many historians have contended that Hitler in this first Barbarossa directive did not go into detail, a misunderstanding due probably to the extremely abbreviated version given in English translation in the NCA volumes. But the complete German text, given in Trial of the Major War Criminals, Volume 26, pages 47 to 52, discloses the full details, thus revealing how far advanced the German military plans were at this early date. The roles of Romania and Finland were defined. They were to provide the jumping-off areas for attacks on the extreme north and south flanks, as well as troops to aid the German forces in these operations. Finland's position was especially important. Various Finnish-German armies were to advance on Leningrad and the Lake Ladoga area, cut the Murmansk rail line, secure the Petsamo nickel mines, and occupy the Russian ice-free ports on the Arctic Ocean. Much depended, Hitler admitted, on whether Sweden would permit the transit of German troops from Norway, but he correctly predicted that the Swedes would be accommodating in this. The main operations were to be divided, Hitler explained, by the Pripet Marshes. The major blow would be delivered north of the swamps with two whole army groups. One would advance up the Baltic states to Leningrad. The other, farther south, would drive through White Russia and then swing north to join the first group, thus trapping what was left of the Soviet forces trying to retreat from the Baltic. Only then, Hitler laid it down, must an offensive against Moscow be undertaken. The Russian capital, which a fortnight before had seemed unimportant to Hitler, now assumed more significance.